Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Today on Change Surfer Radio, I'll be speaking with Colonel Kip Nygren. He's a futurist who teaches at West Point, an engineer who's written recently an article about the impacts of emerging technologies on military futurism. And then later I'll be talking with Philip Shropshire. He writes a column for Better Humans magazine and is a war blogger. I'm speaking now with Colonel Kip Nygren. Colonel Nygren teaches at West Point. He has a background in engineering, PhD from Georgia Tech, and he recently published the article Emerging Technologies and Exponential Change, Implications for Army Transformation in the journal Parameters from the U.S. Army War College, summer 2002, which talks about the singularity, nanotechnology, artificial intelligence, and topics very familiar to the listeners of this show. Welcome, Colonel Nygren.
Thank you.
Your piece talks a lot about the emerging nano, bio, artificial intelligence convergence. How did you get interested in this topic? I mean, your background's in engineering, so I presume you've been following the nano field.
Yes, I went had a sabbatical 2 years ago and was very interested. As a matter of fact, it was Ray Kurzweil's book, probably The Age of Spiritual Machines, that got me interested in this area. And I'm interested in its effect obviously on the world, but more specifically on the Army. And I ended up spending only 6 months thinking about that and how it's going to affect the institution that I've been a member of for a long time.
I know that futurism has some connections to the military. The military is an enormous enterprise, and so probably everything occurs within its in some connection to it. There's the Arlington Institute, some other futurists, the RAND Corporation that does some futurist consulting. But would you say that an interest in futurist speculation about how it's going to affect the military is at a low in the military, or do you find a high interest?
I think an emerging interest, let me say that. We don't have a lot of people who are thinking about those sort of things. Kind of a shame. So there aren't a whole lot. Let me just say that. Not a whole lot being done.
I found recently several think pieces that have been put together about the impacts of nanotechnology and biotechnology on making smart materials, repairing soldiers in the field, making suits that biomonitor as you're in the field. There's that kind of speculation. Is that the kind of thing that you were thinking about as you are trying to encourage the military to think about this, or is it more the societal ramifications of these convergences that are going to create new national security risks?
Well, it's kind of the longer term thinking more than the short term, but it really is all of that. What I find recently is with the high rate of technological change, there's a vast number of technological solutions that are being presented, but there aren't many people who are connecting solutions to problems, and that's what we really need to do in the Army, figure out how they can help us with the missions that we need to perform.
One of the big concerns of people about nanotechnology, biotechnology, you may have seen the piece that was published in Wired by Ray...
Bill Joy,
yes.
Yes.
About the threats that those technologies may face. And now we have the renewed concern about asymmetric warfare and terrorism. These technologies could empower small groups of people with very hostile goals. Is that one of the things you think the military should be thinking more about?
Obviously. Yeah, I think that's very important. Just because there's so much that can be done by few people without a lot of money, not a lot of equipment, we really need to stay in the forefront of what's going on, so we can help to at least predict what we might have to defend against.
In a sense, this war is at least partly about how we control weapons of mass destruction that are made possible by these new emerging technologies, what kind of legislative, political, military regimes we need to minimize their risks.
I think so, but then again, this is at the moment very conventional war, but for reasons that aren't conventional, I guess.
Now, Ray Kurzweil's book is one of the more millennial takes on the new technologies and their possibilities. And there are other folks who look at the same things, Greg Goo and Bill Joy's piece, and see a much more apocalyptic future. You, in your piece, you start by talking about the singularity, the Ray Kurzweil's idea of rapid, dramatic change. And then you go on to talk about how you need to make the Army a learning environment and things like that. But how is it possible to incorporate such a chaotic potentiality into any kind of planning? I mean, if it's chaos and apocalypse, then it's chaos and apocalypse.
You're right. The only thing you can hope to do, and in the end, and I guess it's because I'm an educator, learning is the key. Continuous learning to try to understand all that's going on, to try to then interpret what's going on and decide what the options are and hopefully do the right thing. Modify what our behavior, do those things which can make the world a less dangerous place, I guess. And I see that somewhat as the role of the military.
The Bush administration has been waging a fierce debate about military force structure, whether you need a meaner, leaner military machine, whether we should stick with the two wars doctrine, which apparently we are. How do you think that these technologies have ramifications for the force structure, whether we should have a different kind of military, one which perhaps emphasizes more engineers over grunts?
It informs everything, and I think it does inform that force structure. But what we're finding, of course, is it's not a single force structure. You have to have the ability to handle lots of different situations. So it's a continuum, in a sense, of force structures, or an ability to put together different sorts of organizations that can handle the missions they're assigned. It makes for a much more complicated military organization than we currently have, and that's somewhat of a problem, I think, for us adapting to vast changes.
You make two technological points in your piece. The first is, you say, the design of any military technology is not complete until a defense against it or a way to neutralize it has also been created. And you also say the design of all future technology must consider the possibility of deliberate attempts to convert the new tools into impromptu weapons. I know that you probably aware that the Foresight Institute has been thinking about this, about ways of creating built-in constraints into nanotechnology so that it would not be able to eat things it's not supposed to eat and so forth.
Right.
Have you thought about other applications of this, of these principles of reducing the threat from new technology?
I think the key is, and my area is engineering and obviously engineering design, and that's what I teach, and that's what I've thought about for a while. But as engineers, we have a real responsibility, another ethical and moral responsibility, to try to foresee what these technologies that we're developing can be used for in a non-positive sense, in a violent sense, or an ability to do harm to society. And we got to attempt to foresee that and build in the way to keep that from happening. My background is aerospace engineering, and I can see in the future, as we design airplanes, we have to design some way to ensure that they do not become cruise missiles piloted by humans. You need an abort switch in there, an abort button that disconnects it from any pilot input and automatically lands it at the nearest airport, that sort of thing. Even with those technologies, any that have the potential for great harm.
You make reference in your piece to the Army Continuous Transformation Program and how these kinds of speculations should be incorporated into that. Can you tell us a little bit about what this program is?
Well, you may not know, and of course, if you listen to what's going on in terms of Department of Defense, the Department of Defense is in a process of transformation, and the Army is kind of led that over the past 4 years. The word transformation has become an overused word, but what's happened over the past 4 years with the chief of staff that we currently have, General Shinseki, is the idea of transformation. We have to change. We have to transform ourselves based upon the changing world. What I guess the one thing that I have not liked about it is there seems to be an objective, we call it objective force, that we're going to transform ourselves to. But the point is really not where you're going with this. The point is that transformation is not going to be continuous. We need to get used to an environment of continual change, and it's that process of change that becomes more important. And I've always believed you have a quality process for change. You have the possibility of getting a quality product is greatly enhanced. But if you don't use a quality process for change, I don't know that you know what you'll end up with.
You also mentioned that the Army is not as efficient as a learning organization, partly because of the hierarchical structures. Is there a discussion about making the Army less hierarchical, creating more lateral or team-based structures?
There is, but that's very difficult for the Army to do. And the reason is because, obviously, in a situation such as going on in Iraq right now, there has to be the authoritarian sort of leadership where you tell people to do things and you know it's going to get done and there can't be any need in many cases to question it. You just do it because lots of things are riding on that. But we're not always in that situation. We're not always in that arena where we have to have that sort of command authority or that sort of authoritarian leadership. And it's difficult for us to think of another way or to operate in another mode other than the one that we see is the most important that we use in combat, in time of war. I think that's a problem. We just have to understand when that's useful and when it's not and when other modes are useful. And we're normally pretty good at that. We're better at some times than we are at others. Let me say that, but I think we're beginning to understand that better than we have in the past.
Well, I really want to thank you for coming on today. It's quite a pleasure to see futurist thinking taking place in a serious way within the military structure. We don't usually think of it happening there.
Well, if we don't, we're in trouble. And General Shinseki, I like his statement that if you don't like change, you'll like irrelevance even less.
Been speaking with Colonel Kip Nygren. He's a professor of engineering at West Point Military Academy, and he recently published the piece "Emerging Technologies and Exponential Change: Implications for Army Transformation" in the journal Parameters from the U.S. Army War College, summer 2002. Thanks so much for being with us.
Bye.
I'm Dr. J. This is Change Surfer Radio. Stay tuned for my chat with Philip Shropshire about war blogging. Speaking today with Philip Shropshire, he's a former reporter. He ran a consumer group in Indiana. He now teaches computer skills to kids in the AmeriCorps program, and he is a prolific writer. He writes for his website, Three River Tech Review. He has four different blogs, and he writes a regular column for the Better Humans publication at betterhumans.com, and his column is called Red Hour Orgy. Welcome, Philip.
Oh, how are you, Dr. J? It's a pleasure to talk to you.
The most recent Red Hour Orgy piece that you wrote, Phil, is about the war and the singularity. And without reading it to folks, basically your reflection was that this current war has a lot of ramifications for the way that apocalyptic change will occur with future technologies. Can you tell us more about your thoughts about that?
Yeah, my big thing about the war, I'm not sure if it's actually well, it's primarily a technological objection to the war, but it's also just sort of a common sense, doesn't make any sense argument against the war. I just think that it's unnecessary. But I guess the main argument I was trying to make was that even if you bought in kind of a Machiavellian way that it's okay to kill a lot of people for oil, the war still doesn't make any sense in terms of. At least not in terms of the way technology is progressing. Now, not every technology progresses the way that, say, computers have progressed almost exponentially in terms of how storage works and processing power. But if you were just to do this common sense things like conservation and research into alternative fuels, you probably wouldn't have to kill anybody for fossil fuels. So that's probably the main argument I was trying to make in about over 1,500 words or so.
You run a war blog, and that apparently is a spreading phenomenon. Can you tell us a little bit about war blogging and the blogosphere in general, how you got into blogging?
Well, I run my own site now for about 4 years, and I did it primarily because I've always thought of myself as a writer. I used to work for the corporate press for a number of years, and I could probably tell you many horrible stories about that experience. And the reason I now run two sites, Three River Tech Review and also Magic 12 with a J, is that I wanted to own my own press. There's an old A.G. Liebman quote that says that if the only person who has the freedom of the press is one who happens to own one. And so I wanted to own a couple of my own presses, which is why I have at least two sites. The war blogging that you reference, I'm part of something called War Blogger Watch. And I sort of got into that by accident. As you may know, there are people on the net who are really, really excited about the war and the killing and the murder. And early on, we sort of caught on to those folks. A short list would be like Sergeant Stryker and his dependent and Payman. But there's lots of guys like that who sort of say incredibly hateful things on their blogs. And so I got into that just sort of by accident at War Blogger Watch, and we just sort of write about them and their tendencies to make war look like a very cool thing. Of course, as we speak, the war looks like a pretty hellish thing, like it's a disaster almost. I don't understand the thinking behind the war. Even if we win, you're looking at maybe a 10-year occupation to control the oil. And with an occupation, I don't see how there'll be a democracy or freedom of speech or anything that. I mean, how can you liberate somebody with a gun? I don't understand how I don't even understand. Even if you have the worst intentions about the war to subjugate a foreign people and to take all their stuff, it doesn't seem like that's going to work. You're looking at probably a price tag of about $100 billion at minimum. This is a start.
You also have WWatch, Inane Watch, Magic 12. What are those about?
Well, they're two different sites. The one site, Magic 12, is a site where I write where it's more or less for science fiction and comics. In fact, Red Hour Orgy used to be a column I did for Locus Online. I used to review comics for them. And then I wrote a tough piece on Harlan Ellison's lawsuit. And after that, they kind of didn't want to talk to me anymore. So I just moved Red Hour Orgy over to Better Humans. And essentially, I actually have more things to say about what I think is what I think should be a larger topic, which you touch upon a lot. And that's kind of a liberal left perspective on technology. But Red Hour Orgy has kind of expanded. It used to be just sort of a pop culture column. Now it's a tech commentary column at Better Humans, which is fine. You know, I actually did a piece for Tech Central Station, which is of course the right wing online tech journal where they get all the Exxon ads and where Independent and Payman hang out and write things.
It's a libertarian place.
I don't know. I think at some point, if you support multinationals, you're supporting institutions that are just as restrictive of freedom as big governments. So I'll never understand that. It's a problem I have with Glenn and Pastrell. I don't think they ever recognize that multinationals are just as evil as governments can be when they have monopolistic power and they're unaccountable.
From General Pinochet all the way down to our occupation of Iraq, we're instituting free markets at the end of a bullet.
Yeah, well, they won't be free. I mean, the Halliburton contract, which which they got to clean up, I guess, was no bid. You know, so I mean, it's just something about this whole particular crew. I mean, to be honest, if the war was being run by another crew of sort of, like, say, the DNC crew that you and I probably don't suspect really is sort of Republican light, but at least they're efficient. You know, they can read a speech. They can plan a war so that there are alliances involved. They can attack people, like, say, in Kosovo, where it's pretty clear that there's no material interest in it for them. They do it primarily because it makes some sense on a global scale, or even maybe because it's just ethical to do. But this current crew, I mean, they're not even very good capitalists. There's something that I respect about capitalists who are good at their job, because I know lots of capitalists. A lot of them are really mean people. there's a ruthless edge to them, but they're competent. These guys, to me, aren't even competent. They're like crony capitalists who they know somebody, or their dad was an ex president, or you know, it's nothing to do with like how good they actually are. And I think that's that's how they run the war. The war has been run tactically very badly. One of the best sites I've read is a site by Russian bloggers who are apparently analysts of some kind. And they're sort of impartial, even though you know they're for Mother Russia. But they say some things about the war. I mean, I get what they read, and then I watch CNN and I watch Fox News. And generally, everything that they've written has come true. They said that essentially that we were bogged down. I mean, days before I saw it on CNN or Fox or this new 4 to 6 day delay as we tape this. The problem with this current crew is that they're just a corrupt, incompetent crew. I mean, they're not even good at what they're supposed to be good at, namely capitalism, sort of ruthless capitalism, and increasing. I guess in a way, if we occupy Iraq and we take all the oil, it'll be better for the United States, possibly. But I don't even think they're good at that. I think they'll do it wrong. In fact, if anybody gets in after Bush, we can get rid of him. They'll probably move away from the occupation, the kind of ruthless sort of pocket democracies that demand our sort of proxy control of the oil that we want so bad, apparently.
You also recently wrote a blog, a Red Hour Orgy, about the Big Down Report. Can you tell us about the Big Down Report? And your response to it was that they had missed the big picture about the democratic context of it.
Yeah, actually, well, I'd be honest, I actually thought that it was poetically named, and I thought that it was well-researched. I just didn't think that it made sense because of...
Tell us about what it was.
Oh, the Big Down was actually an analysis and attack against nanotechnology. The Accenture Group has actually had some past success against biotech initiatives in Europe. And I have to be honest, I write for Beyond Better Humans, but I don't necessarily agree with everything. I think that people do have a right to, for example, to demand labeling for biotech foods. I don't necessarily disagree with that. I thought where they were wrong in nanotechnology is that essentially it's going to come. You're not going to be able to stop it and even if we were successful in stopping it in, say, Europe or the United States, you would simply be leaving the field open for, say, China or Osama bin Laden, somebody you didn't really have. I mean, it's not a matter of whether you like it or not. It's going to happen, so you might as well produce it and learn as much about it as you possibly can. I think that it is dangerous. I like Eric Drexler, who almost sounds like an alarmist a lot of times. I think the technology is potentially very, very dangerous, but I still think it has to be explored. In my argument for exploration was I thought that that nanotechs should probably adopt an open source protocol like some of the best coders have done. What I've noticed about open source products is that generally they're better. There's less fluff. It produces not only, I think, a more democratic science, but also better science to begin with. And there have been some people in nanotech and from the Foresight Institute who have addressed this and written about this. I'm not the first one to think about it, but I think it's probably the best counter argument to the just stop theory. And I think that you've mentioned yourself, either, and so I've read a lot of your stuff, by the way, which I enjoy. If you succeeded in banning it, you just push into privatized military hands. It's kind of what's happening with stem cell research right now. You don't really stop it. You just simply send it off to Britain or Singapore, places where they're more open-minded about these kind of technologies. So my argument to them isn't to try to stop it, but try to learn how to grow it in a way that's democratic and open. It's not a matter of if it's going to happen, it's going to happen.
Well, Phil, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. I look forward to reading more of your Red Hour Orgy stuff. Now, you have a couple different sites. Let's plug them all. Three River Tech Review, where you have a large page of links and connections. Mm-hmm. Where is your war blog?
Yeah, the war blog is located on the left-hand side, and it's sort of a group war blog that we write about. It's a lot of writers like Doc Menlow and Eric Blair. I think those are pseudonyms, but they're very cool writers, and I'm glad to be a part of the group. And that's on the left-hand side of the page for the River Tech Review. It's part of Blogger. I mean, you'll be able to find it if you just do a search for where Blogger Watch at Google. And where I write longer pieces is I write something called Inane Ramblings, where I sort of do, that's sort of my longer piece blog, where I do pictures and commentary. And sometimes I usually just post those things on WordBlogger Watch. And I also have a WWatch blog that I write, but I haven't updated it in a while. And the Magic 12 blog is science fiction and comics and music. That's where I know that you're a Peter Wilson fan, so that's where I would do like La Femme Nikita updates or Farscape reviews, that kind of thing.
Hey, if we still had Section around, none of this would ever happen.
Yeah, that was... I agree. You know, it would be a dirty way of doing it, but we'd probably be a lot safer. So,
well, Phil, keep up the writing.
Great. Well, it's an honor to be here. I check out the show every week, and to me, this is a very cool thing. Other than being on NanoDot, this is a very cool thing for me. So,
you've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's jhughes, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.